Psicólogas Podcast.
Hi everyone, we would like to welcome everyone back to the Psicolocas podcast. And as you can see, today we are having our show or our episode, not a show, I'm sorry, our episode in English. And we are doing that because we have a special guest who we will introduce very shortly. But as most of you all may or may not know, February is also Black History Month. And so we wanted to dedicate an episode to celebrating Black History Month and having our own therapist here talk a little bit about mental health and how that looks in the African American community and telling us a little bit about what it's like to be an African American male in the therapy world.
Absolutely. I think we also wanted to highlight, you know, that even though it's not the same experience as being a Black Latinx, it can also resonate with a lot of people because a lot of the cultural beliefs are very similar in terms of what mental health actually symbolizes for our community. So we definitely think that this is an episode that's very, that can be used very diversely in our, in both communities.
Yes. So today we have Daniel Vega. He is a licensed professional counselor, and he is also working on becoming a licensed marriage and family therapist. Is that right, Daniel?
That's correct.
Okay, great. I didn't want to mess that up because, you know, it's like all these letters.
Yeah, alphabet soup.
Exactly. So welcome, Daniel. How are
you? Thank you. Thank you for having me. Doing well. Happy to talk to you too and answer any questions that you have for me.
Yeah, the other thing that we want to share with you guys about Daniel is that Claudia and I have both actually worked with him in our practice. And he's been working with us, well, he was working with us for like 3 years. Then when Claudia was able to move on, I continued to work with him. So he's still my coworker. And so we know him from Mary Center, which is the place where we work.
Yep. MC. Yep.
That place becomes like family in an unhealthy way sometimes. No, I'm just kidding.
Yes, yeah. My Colombian cousins from another mother. Yes, indeed.
That's right.
There you go. All right. Well, to get us started, we first wanted to highlight a couple of things, right? Mental health in the Black community is extremely prevalent, right? Like it shows up a lot. And I think, unfortunately, part of the difficulties that we as mental health professionals have had is reaching that community and being able to receive the services. And that can be, you know, structurally, systemically, right? The inability for people to obtain these services because of the high costs, because of, you know, people living in neighborhoods that don't provide the same amount of services. And so that has really kind of impacted the accessibility of these services, especially the African American community. So we wanted to start out with that and a little bit more, obviously, here in the US, because that's what we're more familiar with. But, you know, I guarantee that it's very similar in other places. I know for a fact that Colombia, my country of origin, is also a place where, first of all, mental health is not very well advertised and portrayed in the media. And so it kind of creates a lot of that stigma that we usually associate with mental health, and especially with the lower socioeconomic status community. So thank you, Daniel, for being with us and kind of giving us a little bit of insight from your perspective. What do you think, you know, where do you think you want to start with your message today? What is the most important thing that you want to share with us right now?
Sure. So the first thing I want to talk about is why I wanted to go into this field in the first place. So I've been a therapist about 10 years now. I got my master's from Lehigh University in 2009 in counseling psychology and human services. And so when I first I mean, when I first went into the field in undergrad, a lot of people told me growing up, well, if you're going to go into the mental health field, you're not worth anything if you don't have a PhD and become a psychologist or a psychiatrist. And so in undergrad, that was my track. Just go be in school for 10 plus years, get my PhD, put up my shingle, have a private practice with the fancy office and the couch, you know, live in a fancy condo like Frasier, but black, you know? So all of that. And those images and dreams were somewhat shattered my senior year of undergrad, because then what I wasn't really prepared for my undergraduate years was just the different paths that I could take. And so it wasn't until my internship, my practicum in grad school, where my supervisor, who was a PhD student, she told me, she said, no, there are a lot of things you can accomplish with a master's in the field if you get your licensing. And so once I was told that, upon getting my master's, that was my track as far as becoming a licensed professional counselor, and then also just learning the different populations I wanted to work with. So that was like the formal. But then as far as just personal, I wanted to go into the field because I know it's a very cliche answer, but I genuinely did want to help people. I initially wanted to become an architect when I was really young, the whole, what do you want to be when you grow up? But I suck at math. And
same with every therapist.
yeah, like I think geometry was maybe the only math class I got straight A's in. But when I learned that math, there was a lot of math with architecture, I said, maybe that's not my path. But in high school, a lot of my friends and even some of my family members, they often came to me telling me about their issues. They would come to me for advice. And I think, looking back on it now, I think it's because I really came, or tried to come for the most part, from a non-judgmental place. And so I think that's why a lot of times people were comfortable just telling me stuff. And that's, you know, one reason I said, maybe this is something I could go into. I first started using therapy when I was in middle school. You know, I was bullied. And so I had a Black male therapist who was a friend of the family. So seeing somebody, you know, a person of color like myself, he definitely influenced me in some way. Shout out to Dr. Chauncey Fort. He definitely was instrumental in motivating me and just seeing, oh, okay, this is something else I could do. So just really wanting to be able to help people. I mean, that's the core of it, but then also learning the different avenues I could take in the mental health field.
I think a lot of us as therapists have a reason behind why we want to help people, but also our own personal experience takes such a like precedence when we choose to be a part of this field. And I think that that's the best way that we can become better therapists is when we actually go through the process of going to therapy. I think Claudia and I have definitely talked about that in our podcast before, that people feel more comfortable or knowing that we also seek therapy for ourselves, or we've gone to therapy to in any aspect of our life, right? Needing that additional support, and just switching a little bit of that like concept of, you know, therapy is for crazy people.
So it sounds like having that role model made a difference for you. It almost made it seem like it was okay. Like, okay, I can do that. I know I've seen another adult figure do this, and they're successful and they're helping me. So this is doable. It's something that felt like attainable. And so one of the things that I wanted to ask you is that I was like reading a little bit and I saw that the National Alliance on Mental Illness talks about how African Americans are less likely than whites to seek out treatment and are more likely to end treatment prematurely. So like, obviously, you know, you can't speak for everyone, but like, what's your take on that? Like, what's going on? What's happening?
Yeah, I mean, so that statement, I definitely, excuse me, I think it speaks on the trust aspect. Mm-hmm. And so I think in a lot of times with people in the African-American community, there's just an overall mistrust in providers because of negative past experiences from therapists to medical doctors to other providers in these fields of not feeling really heard and believed. And so I think the trust, especially if they have a clinician of a different race, and therefore this person is not gonna understand where I'm coming from because they don't look like me, they're not gonna understand my experiences. So why would I open up to a person who's not gonna understand me in the first place? And then I would say another big thing is the stigma. So I think one of you spoke on the fact of, oh, if I see a therapist, that means I'm crazy. And so even in my work today, I'll still have a lot of my Black clients, like they'll say to me, oh, I know I'm crazy because of what I'm about to say, or, oh, this makes me crazy. And it's a matter of just, okay, what is your definition of crazy? Because your crazy may not be the same as mine, not even just as a clinician, but just me as a human being. So there's just that psychoeducation conversation of, okay, your definition of crazy, and then also what brought you in here, especially if you're the one, if it was a self-referral and you said to yourself, I think I need to see a therapist for my challenges, problems, whatever it is. So there's definitely the stigma that I think keeps a lot of Black people from wanting to see a therapist.
How do you think that it's different working with a therapist that is from your similar background as opposed to somebody who's different than you and looks different than you?
Yeah, so I definitely think the comfort level, for one, so even if that client has different experiences from me, say, you know, we came from a different SES, culturally, if, for example, they're a first generation from whatever country that their parents are from, I think just seeing someone who looks like them, there's like that automatic comfort of, okay, this person, though I don't know their whole life, maybe they've dealt with racism in some shape or form. They've dealt with discrimination. They've been the only Black person in the room. They've maybe have some similar experiences, and therefore I feel comfortable because they're going to understand some of the experiences I've been through.
That's really interesting, Daniel, because, you know, well, both of you know that I'm certified in parent-child interaction therapy, which is, for those of you listening, is a attachment-based and behavioral model that really works on the parent-child relationship. And a majority of that therapy really requires the therapist and the parent to be, you know, one, right? Because we're basically coaching the parent how to discipline their child when the child is misbehaving or having challenging behaviors. But part of my experience and part of the research in the PCIT community is that many African Americans don't like this modality because it really hasn't been adapted for African American families. And it just like misses the mark in the way that it's designed. It's really designed supposedly for, you know, like white culture, white race. And I think there's been a lot of tweaking that's been done for it to apply to Latino populations, but for whatever reason, they haven't found exactly the right way to tweak the model for African-American families. And what I've experienced is that a lot of times the families come in for a couple of sessions and then they don't come back. And I do really think that, you know, if the client doesn't trust you and if you're not understanding of their culture and their cultural background, and that maybe mom is not the main figure, but it's grandmother or there's an aunt or something like that. And just like those types of things, like those little nuances, which maybe don't seem like a big deal, but they do, you do lose that rapport. So I think what basically saying, like, I've seen what Daniel is talking about in my experience. And so I've tried to like read up on it and try to figure out ways that I can really connect with the family members so that they feel like it's a safe space to come into and also share with me genuinely like what's going on in the home, right? Because if they're holding things back, then like I can teach them all of the things, but if it's not applicable in their home, then it's not going to work.
Yeah, I mean, I think what could be helpful for some clinicians of a different race or cultural background is to acknowledge that. And I would say, I mean, it's more apparent now because of what's been going on in the US in the past year, you know, with George Floyd and Black Lives Matter and all that. But I think even before that, it should have always been a conversation. It should have always been a part of someone's training as early as undergraduate, in the sense that once you're out there, you are going to be working with people who don't look like you and don't have your shared experiences. How do we address that when it comes up? You know, and granted, there's no one answer fits all type of solution, but that definitely is a part of the conversation. Yes, I don't look like you. I may not have had your experiences. Let's talk about that. That could be a few sessions at the start of therapy.
And that definitely wasn't covered in my undergrad or graduate program in terms of like, let's have this conversation that might start off awkward, but probably needs to happen at the forefront in order for us to be able to do some really good work together.
Feeling uncomfortable is one of the things that we kind of talk about making our clients go through like an uncomfortable situation, but being able to tolerate it and being able to say, hey, like, it's not so bad, right? Like once you start using all these coping skills and stuff, that can help alleviate a little bit of that initial shock of like, oh, you're going through something new, different. Yet we shy away from doing it in our own practice at times because it is uncomfortable, and it's uncomfortable for us as therapists as well. So acknowledging that and being able to bring that in the room will open up so much more of what other people are feeling in terms of feeling uncomfortable, right? And feeling like if this person who's in front of me is vulnerable enough to say that they're uncomfortable and being okay with that, then that might open up room to really have these tough conversations that would be very beneficial and that have proven to be very beneficial in the relationship, while also being able to set boundaries and having even the participant, the consumer, being able to say, hey, like, maybe I don't feel comfortable with this person. And if that's not happening in the therapy room, then being able to say, hey, you know what, like, I'm going to go look for a different therapist that actually values and acknowledges that these conversations need to happen.
Yes. So I don't know if you guys watch This Is Us, because I'm obsessed with This Is Us, but Sterling K. Brown, there's an episode when he starts seeing a therapist, which first of all, for him, his character was really hard to do to begin with. And he starts to see this therapist, and I think the therapist is lovely. And he's just like, he's not feeling it. And he's struggling with it. And he's trying to power through. But then there's this really powerful episode where he calls and he literally just says, like, I need a Black therapist. Like, you're great. Like, you're super trained. You've helped me see a lot of things, but I need a Black therapist. I'm going to look for a Black therapist. And then the therapist was so great too, because she was like, totally get it. Like, let me help you find a Black therapist that fits you and feels good and you feel connected with. And that's a really hard conversation to have, because I know, like, my therapist is a white lady. She has no real concept of Latinx, like anything. And she's great. But have I ever been like, no, actually, this is like a cultural, like, no, because I feel like it's like, I feel bad saying it. So I was really glad that in This Is Us, they made it a point to like write that into the show. I thought it was really powerful.
I don't watch the show because I joke with people that it might remind me too much of work. I think I'll watch it when the show is done. I'm just going to binge all the seasons. But my friend did want me to watch that one episode. I think it was the episode where he saw the therapist for the first time, because they didn't even show the therapist on the screen, right?
Not in the beginning. They showed it later, yeah.
Okay,
We just spoiled it for everybody. Well, that's
But spoiler it's so alert. Good, you should watch it anyway. Yeah,
I did watch that episode, and I actually liked that they didn't show the therapist's face and really just focused on his perception, because I thought that was actually a really accurate representation just of that mistrust that I was talking about earlier.
And it's finally a therapist that's not being, you know, portrayed as the bad guy, right? Like being the one that's taking advantage of the power, but just being
that
very, very vulnerable and saying, hey, that's totally up to you. I'm here to do what's best for you and not what's on my agenda. Mm-hmm. And you know, in terms of the show, there's so much more about, you know, the character that like that episode is really powerful in terms of even, you know, I don't want to talk about the show forever, but you know, he was adopted in a white family, so like there was a lot of things that he probably never was taught to do because he wasn't with people that looked like him, and he didn't really know how to act, you know, in this family that he was the only one that was different, right?
Yeah.
And so either way, I think that they did a good job of just portraying that whole experience of him, and kind of goes into what we were talking about here in terms of the stigma and being able to acknowledge needing to go to therapy and being able to say, hey, like, you know, I think one of the things, Daniel, you were saying before is that normally in the Black community, it's very much focused on going to church, right? And not so much about the mental health. But, you know, if you can tell us a little bit more about, you know, what your experience has been with this and how you've seen this play out in your personal experience or just, you know, in the work that you've done.
Yeah, definitely. So I went to college in the South. I went to Tennessee State University, TSU, HBCU Pride. Yes, I had to shout that out. So going to school in the South, I mean, that was one of the first times, I think, even in just telling people I was majoring in psychology and wanted to go into that field, I definitely got a lot of, why would you do that? Why are you doing that? Why are you going to spend all day? Oh, you're going to spend all day just talking to crazy people. You know, you're going to go crazy yourself. Don't you know, like, Black therapists, like people who become therapists, like, are the number one group to commit suicide? You know, no. Oh, let me connect you to these resources and tell you da da da. But with the church aspect, I mean, my mother's side of the family is from the South. And so church, I mean, even in my current life, church is very much been an integral part of my life. And so for a lot of people, prayer and talking to their pastor is the therapy. And just going back to the trust conversation, I think a person who's been a longtime member of their church and they have a good working and even maybe personal relationship with their pastor, there's that element of, okay, this person knows me in this way that I know I can feel comfortable telling them about certain things. And some pastors, they are actually formally trained as therapists, like either they got a degree in pastoral counseling or their master's in counseling before going to divinity school. Maybe some have their PhD, but not all of them do. And so it can become a problem because, you know, and this isn't to knock certain pastors, but it's just, it's not the non-biased model approach that most therapists would use with the person. There's sometimes an element of judgment or whatever the particular beliefs are of that church's denomination. And so it's not therapy like in the traditional sense. But for a lot of people, mental illness isn't necessarily a thing that's a diagnosable thing, and it's in this book. It's, you know, no, that's, you know, the devil messing with you. The person is, I mean, there's so many terms, like, oh, what's the term? Touch. That person is touched.
Oh, I've heard that. I've heard that. Like, they're touched. Yeah.
Yeah, they're touched. You know, they're a little funny. And then my mom's family is from the South. So it's always these different terms, like their bread's not all the way done.
Oh,
their screws aren't all the way loose. So there's that then puts the negative spin on therapy too, because there's this negative connotation associated with it, in the sense that you are not a whole person. And so with the church, you know, it's like church in prayer and having God in your life is to help with that wholeness. So why talk to a person about that when I can just talk to about it with God? Especially if that person maybe feels that the therapist doesn't practice a faith. And so I've definitely had clients of all races, like they'll ask me if I practice a religion, what church do I go to? And depending on the relationship I have with that client, I might just give them like a little
a little teaser,
a little snippet. Yeah, yeah. but are we praying together in the session? No. But what I will do, I mean, for example, like if I do an echo map and just seeing like what the different people's supports are, if church is a support for them, I do encourage, you know, them to, you know, use it, but also just highlighting the differences of, okay, this is how your church can help you, but it's going to be different from this traditional therapy that we're doing.
Absolutely. It's like going to marriage counseling to a priest who will, you know, will always say, hey, divorce is not the way, because, you know, and it's helpful for some people because maybe that's the way that they want to view, you know, their marriage. But like, if it's not safe, like, we don't want to say that, right? And we as therapists kind of have that objectivity that maybe isn't there all the way with what you said in terms of like religion. But definitely, you know, not to say that the DSM is not, you know, I think it's very problematic in general, right? But having some sort of guideline of how we can kind of expect the therapist to interact with certain mental illnesses is also helpful, mm-hmm. right? And so being able to do more research, right, on African-American and Black mental health needs to still happen, right? I think that there's so much more that we need to, including this aspect of using your faith and using church as maybe that support system, right? That can help you and contribute to your well-being without necessarily saying that therapy or that church is better one or the other. They both can go together. And I think that that's one of the things that, you know, we as therapists will try to take into account when we're having these racially motivated conversations. Is there, I guess it's been difficult to, like we said in the beginning, to have that trusting relationship with the Black community because of numerous reasons that we've already kind of mentioned. What advice would you give to somebody whose family member is struggling with mental health and they don't know how to help them, even though they recognize that it might be a mental health related illness that is kind of causing issues?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, because there's definitely people in my life now where that's been an issue. One of my close friends, I actually was helping her help her dad help the siblings as far as just how to help in that moment. And so usually, like, I'm pretty direct in the sense of like, okay, these are the best numbers, or like these are the type of people to call for this situation. But as far as, and that's, I guess that's dependent on where the person, I guess if the person is with the mental health issue is willing to get the help.
Right.
But if there's a denial piece to it, the approach I usually say is to just have a general conversation with the person first about what they're experiencing. Because I think that's telling as far as just what to do next. Because if there's that denial that the person even has issues, it's not, oh, you need to talk to somebody about this.
No, you got to tread lightly.
Yeah. So,
yeah, you can't say that.
That's not the approach.
That's not going to help.
Not at all. But it's definitely, I think, doing a check-in. And I always tell people, it's best to like use yourself and really, you know, as tough as it is, like really be transparent of how it's making you feel. So it really hurts me to see you like this. Like, I don't know specifically what's going on with you, but I'm really concerned, and just seeing if that maybe lands differently than, oh, you need to see a therapist. There's something wrong with you.
Good old use of the I statements.
Yep.
Yes. It's funny because I actually had this conversation with my therapist about a family member of mine that was concerning me. And once she encouraged me to say something like, I've been thinking of a lot about you. And I think that's a really like neutral way of saying I'm worried about you, because sometimes when you tell someone like, hey, like I'm worried about you, they're going to be like, don't worry about me then. Mm-hmm. Like, right. Like it could come off in a way that you don't want it to. And so kind of starting off with something like, you know, I've been thinking a lot about you lately. You've been on my mind. Mm. That's a little like more like peaceful and maybe may not have such a defensive reaction.
Well, it's,
and I think that can go across the board. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That can go across the board, all races, right? Like, I think when I think about, you know, I think the same issues are found in the Latinx community about having that conversation with someone. It's like, you got to be careful when you have to say it in a way, because you say therapist or psychologist and it's like, you're calling me crazy.
But also not being able to have the conversations, right? Because I feel mm-hmm. like a lot of people will avoid it rather than actually address it head on. And then you lose the opportunity to get to that person and to really build kind of like that trusting relationship with somebody that could really benefit from even having you as a support system. Like, hey, I'm able to come to you if I do decide to go to therapy, if I do decide to ask for help, that at least I know that you're not going to judge me for going, you're not going to think I'm crazy for reaching out for help. So being a support system for that person is just as essential in having that conversation and being there for them.
Yeah. And Daniel, I have another question, I guess, for you. And, you know, I think obviously this year has been really hard for everyone. And I do think that COVID has particularly hit communities of color much harder than others. And on top of that, we've had all of this racial tension that I personally feel like has affected my mental health. Like, I just can't stand for everything that's been going on, which has been difficult, but I'm sure that being a Black therapist, have you noticed that's a conversation that your Black clients are having with you? Is that something that's coming up for them too?
It's definitely coming up, and I've had to talk about it with colleagues just as far as how to approach it. So, mm-hmm. so one fortunate thing that our agency has done that I'm really grateful for, we've been having group supervisions with other therapists who identify as people of color. And it's been really helpful because those conversations definitely have come up, and I've had to consult with my colleagues as far as, okay, as the therapist, how far do you go? Because I mean, there's times where I want to be like, yes, that's bullshit. That's, you know, that's fucked up, you know, but I also have to remember my professional role mm-hmm. and still frame it in a therapeutic construct. So I'm definitely doing a lot of joining in the sense of, I hear you, like some of these stories I'm reading, they boil me up on the inside. And I'm curious to know like how you're dealing with it, you know, without making it too much about me, because, you know, it's not my therapy. You know, I want to make sure that the client is still getting something out of the session. But yeah, it's been a big hanging cloud.
I'm sure. I don't get to see as many clients anymore as I used to, because I'm in a different kind of role, but I've been thinking about it a lot lately, and I've been like, I don't know how, like this, I feel like right now is a really tough time to be a therapist.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's happening mm-hmm. as a supervisor, right? You might have not had that much contact with clients this year, but there's definitely an increase in these conversations also in the supervisory mm-hmm. therapist role, right? Like there's, even if it's not a supervisor, but another staff person, right? Like mm-hmm. just being able to acknowledge that, you know, a manager is a position of power that has a lot of say in what happens to a person who doesn't have as much power. And so racial inequality definitely shows up in those relationships as well. And again, like Daniel was saying, it's something that we are being able to talk about in our agency and hopefully in many more around the country and the world. But it definitely shows up just in those conversations of how are we really treating each other and how are we really being forced to look at ourselves in how we're affecting other people, you know, whether it's based on the difference of race or just age or being able to, you know,
gender.
Exactly. So like all of these things have definitely major impact, but definitely because of everything that's happening, I think even people I supervise, I've talked about, you know, recent events that have caused and triggered a lot of anxiety, a lot of, you know, depression in some about what's currently being portrayed on TV and how it's being addressed and how it's being handled by, you know, politics and all these things that really affect how safe you feel in the world.
Yeah. Daniel, any words of wisdom to the Black therapists out there that are, you know, doing this there in there with you? I mean, I feel like it's got to be really hard to be a Black therapist right now. So anything that works really well for you that maybe you want to share with other therapists out there?
Yeah, I think it's definitely important to make sure you have at least one person. I don't want to say ally, because but like
say it.
Yeah. But it is good to have, like, find your network. So especially, so I've worked in other agencies where I was the only Black person, and my quote for that, my analogy is the only raisin in the oatmeal. And I think for some Black therapists out there, they may be in cities, communities, and towns that aren't as diverse. So it's important to find a network. And I think now it may actually be a little easier because of COVID and because so many things are just online and Zoom and yada yada. So I think just finding people that you can connect with in that way and just talk about maybe some of those challenges, but then also a lot of the positives, and just finding, I think it's, I want to say like a mentorship too, because I think talking with somebody, I've definitely had some people in my life, Black therapists from the time I was in school up until now, helping me. So I think just finding like that connection and finding mentorship is going to help in the long run. And it never stops.
No, so basically we just need to resume our happy hours is what I'm hearing. Once COVID is over.
Yeah, COVID just needs to go away.
Yeah.
I guess one last question that I wanted to ask Daniel. We're seeing a huge disparity in vaccine distributions, talking about COVID, you know, and kind of going in line with, you know, the trusting relationship. Do you talk to your clients about the vaccine? Do you tell them, you know, if you feel comfortable taking the vaccine yourself, do you tell them, do you not talk about it? Do they ask, how do you handle that?
Yeah, that's a good question too, because it's been a mix. Initially I wasn't going to tell clients that I got the vaccine. When clients ask, I am transparent with that and say, like, I did get the vaccine. I don't necessarily tell them my reasons, but I'm mindful to not influence theirs should they decide to get it or not. And so again, just with the trust piece, I think the conversation I just have with them is, okay, you know, you're choosing not to get the vaccine. How are you, you know, what are your plans in navigating through life with COVID-19 and any virus? I mean, because then they'll usually say, well, I never got my flu shot either. So I really come at it from, okay, well, what are you doing to just ensure your own safety? versus no, you need to get it. I got it and you should get it too. It's just a lot of education. Sometimes, depending on the client, like I'll encourage them to just maybe do some reading and just do some research, you know, because I think for some people, if there's some ambivalence with it, they just need to get more informed about it, and that can maybe make them feel more comfortable. But I really try to be mindful to not influence them and tell them, no, like, you need to get it because I got it.
I'm glad you said that, because I feel like I haven't done a good job at that. I'm gonna be like, no, everybody needs to get it. We should all be getting it. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, but no, that's a really good practice. I'm going to take that up with myself and just say, you know, why that I believe that it's safe to get it and why I did it for myself. But I think that in terms of like the Latino community, like everyone in my family, I'm like, no, everyone's getting it. We're all getting it. We're all going to be at Thanksgiving next year. Like, everyone's getting it. But that's really important to keep in mind, right? Like, you got to be respectful. You have to really let people make, it's a personal decision. Everyone has different reasons to and not to get it. And especially in, you know, the communities of color, like we all know, you know, the things that have happened in the past in terms of like Tuskegee and like all of that. So like, we need to be respectful and, you know, quite, you know, I think what Daniel said is spot on, which is, I think a lot of it comes from not having enough information.
And having somebody to tell them, right? Like, you being able to provide them with that guidance just has like an open door to more questions, to say, hey, yeah, like, this is somebody that I can come talk to about these things that are not, you know, they're kind of like a taboo, right? Like, somebody that, yeah, the family, they might be like, you're absolutely not getting that. Okay, mm-hmm, tell me why. Like, I want to have that conversation and be able to be respectful, like Claudia said, of like, that's okay, right? Like, if you're not ready, if you don't feel like this is the best option for you, then how are you going to keep yourself safe, right? Because, mm-hmm, that's what we as therapists are always trying to do, is keeping our participants, our consumers safe.
Right.
Thank you so much for spending time with us tonight and being able to share all of your experience, or some of it.
Yeah. Thank
but definitely you. Having you is hopefully going to help a lot of people, you know, be able to talk to their families, or just even just bring the subject to the dinner table and be able to have more discussions about, you know, mental health and being open to even just asking questions about it.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Thank you. Thank you, Daniel. And, you know, as always, if you find it helpful and you want to share it with someone, please share it and, you know, let them know. And if they speak Spanish, we also have our other episodes in Espanol. So follow us at Psicolocas Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. All so right. Much.
Thanks to you too again.
Contenido producido por Psicolocas Podcast y que siguen en nuestras redes sociales como textos, gráficos, imágenes y otro material persiguen solo fines informativos y de instrucción.
El contenido no pretende ser un sustituto del asesoramiento, diagnóstico o tratamiento médico profesional.
Siempre busque el consejo de su médico u otro proveedor de salud calificada con cualquier pregunta que pueda tener con respecto a una condición médica.
Nunca ignore el asesoramiento médico profesional ni se demore en buscarlo debido a algo que haya escuchado o visto en Psicolocas Podcast.
Si cree que puede tener una emergencia médica, llame a su médico al 911 o al número de emergencia local inmediatamente.
Psicolocas Podcast no recomienda ni aprueba ningún médico, pruebas psicológicas, productos, procedimientos, opiniones u otra información específica que pueda mencionarse en este.
La confiabilidad en cualquier información proporcionada por Psicolocas Podcast y la de aquellos que aparezcan en él, así como otros visitantes, se hará bajo su propio riesgo.